big box now to move on, Rick. I can walk around and everything in the. If you see this thing here, we're on the. Now he's playing. Now he's playing with me. He's playing with me from back in the booth. Apocalyptic. Did you hear about the apocalypse? It sounds scary. This, of course, is the famous mural in Kansas of John Brown, precursor of the Civil War. Bible in one hand, opened up with big Alpha and Omega. Gun in the other hand. Scary, dramatic, shocking, bracing. But Nancy's here because Nancy texted me that she went and saw this movie, Jesus Revolution. Anybody else see the movie? Okay, Edie saw it. Roger saw it. I haven't seen it yet. I'll probably see it when it comes to streaming. The movie's got a lot of attention. It's about the Jesus people in Southern California. Now, many of you in this room were older than I was when that whole thing came through. It's a very interesting story. I remember as a kid, our house, like many houses in America, would get Time Magazine, and Time Magazine had one issue called The Jesus Revolution, and that's sort of where the movie gets its title. I find in our culture a lot of nostalgia for the summer of love and the hippies and the counterculture. If you read history, it's not quite that rosy. One person there described the summer of love as, the flower movement was like a valley of thousands of plump white rabbits surrounded by wounded coyotes. What started out with some rock concerts and everybody going to San Francisco with flower in their hair, one person said, what they should have said is, if you're going to San Francisco, bring a sleeping bag and a sandwich because you're probably not going to find a place to stay. Drugs, sex, rock and roll very quickly led to trauma and wounds and neglected children. One guy in this world whose name pops up in many of the histories is Ted Wise. Ted Wise was grew up not too far from here, was up in Auburn, went into the Navy, learned how to sail, and actually became pretty handy with sailcloth. You wouldn't imagine learning that in the modern Navy, but became adept with sailcloth and then began to work on some of those boats, the sailboats that are there in the San Francisco Bay, and was really enjoying his life there. He was taking all sorts of drugs. He was having all sorts of girlfriends. He had a wife and a couple of kids. He was doing all of this, and then he began to realize that this new life that he loved so well did not really work very well for his wife and his children. And his wife stumbled into the Mill Valley Baptist Church in 1967. There's a picture of the pastor and his family. And those of us who remember the 60s know that a lot more people looked like the pastor and his family than looked like the flower children. You know, so you had the, you know, you had the squares, the straights, and of course the groovy people. And Ted Wise's wife stumbled into that church really looking for something, because her husband's drug habit and her husband's philandering was really causing her a lot of concern. She didn't know what she was going to do with herself and her children. Ted eventually visited that church. He was still high on LSD, but he kept walking around the church saying, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming. And nobody knew what he was talking about. Bit by bit, Wise began to convert. And one thing led to another, and before you knew it, there were all sorts of hippie rescue coffee shops in Haight-Ashbury and other places that were sort of picking up people who started out with the drugs and wound up really with a lot of depression, and began ministering to people. And bit by bit by bit, a thing started about Jesus and the new counterculture. Part of what held these people together was a sense of a deeply apocalyptic age. Another characteristic of their strong apocalyptic belief that they are living in the last days, and that they were the last youth generation that would live on the earth. 1968, of course, brought the Tet Offensive, the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., of Robert F. Kennedy, the Democratic Convention, which exploded in riots. Nixon was elected, promising law and order. It was in the middle of the Cold War, and a lot of people wondered, we're not going to get out of this mess as a species. We're going to nuke each other, or one thing or another is going to happen, and the whole system's going to collapse. And so what a lot of those young people putting flowers in their hair and wearing colors and bell bottoms before it became more fashionable in the 70s, which many of you also remember, this can't go on. We're the last kids on Earth. This theme of world ending is perennial throughout history. Listen to Jesus talking to his disciples in Matthew 24. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him to call his attention to the buildings. Now, these were massive stones that Herod had brought in, and the temple was glorious, and people would come from all over the world to Jerusalem just to see the sights and to see this great temple that Herod had refurbished. And the disciples were sort of in awe, pointing this out to Jesus when they were all visiting it. And Jesus said, "Do you see these things? Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." This was in the 30s. It would be in the 60s, 70 AD to be exact, that what Jesus said would happen. And then they walked up to the Mount of Olives overlooking the city. And Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately and said, "Tell us, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nations will rise against nation, kingdoms against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of the birth pains. So if anyone tells you he is out there in the wilderness, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner room, do not believe him. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall down from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you will know that it is near, right at the door. Truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time at night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the Lord has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Truly I tell you, he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But suppose a servant is wicked and says to himself, "My master is staying away a long time. And then he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of. And he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Wow. Cutting people up, signing a place with the hypocrites, outer darkness, lightning from one side of the sky to another. This text has been provoking our imagination about the end of the world since Jesus said it. One of the things you find with Christians all along the way for 2,000 years is everybody imagining exactly what those hippies imagined. This can't go on much longer. It's all going to come to an end. It's going to come crashing down. And where will I be? Martin Luther, at the beginning of the 16th century, was a young man studying law. He was traveling through the woods that night, and a thunderstorm came. If you've ever been in a bad thunderstorm in the woods, we Californians don't get bad thunderstorms out here. It's a terrifying thing. He fell on the ground and cried out to Saint Anne to save him. And he really bothered his father when he gave up pursuing a law degree and decided to be a monk. He did so because everyone was expecting the imminent coming of Christ. Columbus had gone to America. All kinds of strange stories of different peoples at the end of the world. This can't go on much longer. And what better could he do than take the cowl? Martin thought, if Jesus is coming, I want to be found in a monastery confessing my sins. Men believed the end of the world already had been postponed for the sake of the Cistercian monks. Jesus had just bidden the angel blow the trumpet for the last judgment when the Mother of Mercy fell at the feet of her son and besought him to spare a while, at least for my friends of the Cistercian order, that they may prepare themselves. The very devils complained of Saint Benedict as a robber who had stolen souls out of their hands. He who died in the cowl, as a monk, that's what that means, would receive preferential treatment in heaven because of his holy garment. Now, this has gone on a long time, and some of you remember, right after the hippies came Hal Lindsey, the late great Planet Earth. And in fact, the rough draft of this video I put on my channel, and someone left a comment, yeah, in the early 70s, my father was buying these books and giving them away, warning everybody, the signs of the time are clear. The Soviet Union is the great bear. Israel is back in her land in Jerusalem, and it's coming to an end. This breezy dispensational apocalypticism sort of made Christ's second coming laughable when, well, the 80s moved on and the Soviet Union fell. And then, not only late great Planet Earth, but 1980 countdown to Armageddon just seemed a little dated. Memories of Luther or apocalyptic hippies imagining themselves to be the last generation sort of creates new atheist eye rolls. Oh, you Christians, you're always waiting for Jesus to come back. It's been 2,000 years, will you give it up? But what's really weird is that if you pay any attention at all to what's going on in our culture, if you ask people today, well, I don't dare have babies. This is the last generation. There's no future to humanity. Why would I want to bring a baby in this world to die with global warming or nuclear war or environmental collapse or economic catastrophe? There's no future for humanity. You see this on television. The most popular shows, like the current one, The Last of Us, seems like every 6 months or a year, someone is spinning out a new apocalyptic yarn that says the future is dystopian with a few people living in rags trying to scratch out a living. Well, you sound like a hippie. You sound like Martin Luther. You sound like humanity has painted itself into a corner, and we're probably not going to get out of this mess. Oh, well, that's pretty normal. Every generation, it seems, faces the fear that this can't go on much longer. Now, your religion may or may not have a holy book, but apocalyptic is not restricted to Christians. Now, here's the funny thing about this word apocalypse. It's the title of the book of Revelation. It's not Revelations, it's Revelation, apocalypse. Christian apocalyptic is not just zombies or viruses or nuclear war. Christian apocalypse is always two-sided. It's a day of disaster, and it's a day of release and opportunity. Both are there in the idea. The hippies looked around and said, this can't go on much longer. But it did. Jesus just can't seem to stay in the grave. People come stumbling out of dead ends with faith to go forward and the belief that they proceed in hope. Christian apocalypse is always a realized apocalypse. Every time we do joys and concerns, we have tiny little apocalyptic moments. There's a shooting down the street from Lula. They've taped off her house. Someone died in there. My child had a baby, a new grandson. All of these tiny little apocalyptic moments that stop us and shock us and ask us about the nature of life. Jesus keeps revealing himself anew to generations that have painted themselves into a corner. Ted Wise stumbled into that church and his life changed. Didn't give up drugs right away. That would be a longer conversation. Didn't give up womanizing right away. Well, that sort of petered out. But Jesus got a hold of him, and he pretty much saw the end of the world was coming, at least the end of his world, and he knew something needed to change, and it began to put him on a road where the drugs would taper off, the womanizing would stop, the relationship would improve, there'd be milk in the fridge for the kids, life would go on, and Ted Wise would become an early adopter to a movement that would transform Christianity in America, and still does. Jesus is really funny with the apocalypse because Jesus keeps sort of offering what I call a shopkeeper apocalypse. Now, the text for today comes in Matthew 25. And it's a very strange text, because again, it involves a wedding banquet. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, there's a lot of conversation because we don't exactly know the first century Jewish wedding practices, but it's quite clear that they were something similar to our maids of honor, who were probably friends of the bride, and at some moment they would wait and they would escort the bridegroom into the wedding feast, and things would happen and they would have to wait, and the kind of lamps probably weren't these little lamps with oil. They might have been something like torches where there's oil-soaked rags, and so you go out there and you have them lit, but if you wanted to light it again, you had to sort of reassemble the things, and you needed oil to do this. And so Jesus takes this thing and says, this is a picture of how I want you to be in a world that is unstable and unreliable, where everything can fall apart at any given time. The kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins, 10 young ladies who are not married, who are bridesmaids in a sense, who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. You can see this is very apocalyptic. It's night. It's dark. Something is coming. We don't know when. The foolish ones took their lamps, but did not take any oil with them. The wise ones, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. Now, if you remember the parables we just read, Jesus says, stay awake. But we all know, physically, you can't just stay awake. Jesus is clearly telling people to stay awake spiritually, in a sense. And so all of these bridesmaids fall asleep, waiting deep into the night. Will he come? We don't know. What's interesting is that Jesus, in the midst of all of this apocalyptic that you can't do much about, not one stone will be left on another, Jesus advises them to do fairly small, little, common sense things. Bring some extra oil. I remember at men's group a number of years ago when we were still meeting here at church, we're online now, we're reading through the book of Timothy. And in the book of Timothy, there's this list of attributes that church leaders should have. And I remember reading this list and thinking, these are shopkeeper values. Listen to this list. Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now, an overseer means someone who is sort of looking out for a church. Today, we would probably call it an elder. Now, the elder is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. Now, if you look at the history of religions, you find that, well, there's this bumper sticker for a while, well-behaved women seldom make history. I always smile when I see that bumper sticker because I think, well-behaved people seldom make history. History seems to be given to the loud, the bombastic, the impulsive, the risk-takers. There are plenty of parables about those kinds of values, too. But when Paul says, who can be trusted to run a church? Well, look at the list. Above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. It's almost the kind of person you want to find as an employee for your store. Will they show up on time? Will they rob from the till? Will they be good at customer service? Will they help keep the thing going? Boy, that's awfully plain. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him. And he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. In other words, if the only reason his children obey him is because he beats them, well, that's not the kind of thing you want. Sometimes people say to me in church, Pastor Paul, can you get this person to do that? And I will say to them, would you like me to beat them? So, no, Pastor. Oh, okay. Well, how exactly would you like me to get that person to do such and such? Well, you'll talk to them. Oh, okay. These are the kinds of qualities Paul is looking for. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with others, so he will not fall into disgrace, into the devil's trap. This person sounds almost boring. And Paul says, this is the kind that can actually shepherd a flock. At midnight, back to Matthew 25, the cry rang out. The apocalypse has come. Here's the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Everyone's drowsy, waking up, not knowing what to do. Well, Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish one said to the wise, give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out. No, they replied, there may not be enough for both of us, for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some of them yourselves. But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived, and the virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Last week we heard about a wedding banquet. Jesus loves to tell these wedding banquet stories, and they all have some of the same features. Now, this oil in the parable is something that can't really be shared, sort of like preparation. Have you ever gone and taken a test at school? You can't turn to your neighbor and say, give me some of what you studied. That can't be shared. No, there's a time of preparation and there's a time of apocalypse. Are you going to be ready? Nobody can do it for you. You have to do it yourself. The preparation for the inbreaking of Jesus into your mundane, expected, satanic Peter imagination. Remember Peter with how he thought Jesus should go about things? And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. This can't be outsourced. You alone can do it for you. If you want to be ready to receive the end of history, Jesus, the everyday apocalypse, Jesus, the inconvenient Jesus, no one can do it for you. You have to ready yourself. You had better have enough oil in your life to light the torch and join him at the wedding banquet. And again, last week we asked these questions. Well, who's the king? Well, that seems obvious. Well, who's the prince or the groom? Well, that seems to be Jesus. Who's the bride? And who are the bridesmaids? Now, this is where we come to the same way the last parable ended. And you find this in Jesus' parables all over the place. There's a party going on inside, and the master of the party says, I've been waiting for this. We're going to have this party. Nothing but nothing is going to disturb it. You're in or you're out. You see this in all of Jesus' apocalyptic parables. Later, the others came, the bridesmaids who had run to town, who didn't have their oil ready. They got back. They went to town, and they knocked down the guy's door and said, get me some oil. I need it now. And the shopkeeper gives them oil. And then they run back, and what do they find? They hear noise, they hear music, they hear dancing, they hear everything going on, but the door is locked, and they pound on the door. Lord, Lord, they said, open the door. We're ready now. But here's the irony. They don't need their torches anymore. That moment has passed. But he replied, the Lord of the party, truly I tell you, I don't know you. What do you mean? You'll find this in the Sermon on the Mount. Lord, Lord, did we not heal the sick and raise the dead? Depart from me. I never knew you. This apocalypse thing is all about us. It's not just for Martin Luther. It's not just for the hippies. It comes to all of us. The shut door, the outer darkness, the exclusion from the banquet, pleading to come in, but it's too late. This is Jesus talking. Jesus is not a quivering mass of availability. Jesus demands of people, you'd better be ready, because if you're not ready, you're on the outside. This is life. We all know this. Jesus again would say, keep watch. Why would he say this to a generation who would die 2 millennia before you could read this? What are you to watch out for? Well, Jesus' apocalypse comes, this day of the Lord comes in tiny little ways, and it comes in big ways. And in some ways, the little apocalypse should get us ready for the big one. Because the big one is coming for all of us. The apocalyptic Christ saves in ways we simply don't expect. He allows his blood to be shed when we expect him to shed the blood of his enemies. He demands constant vigilance when we've let the guard down, our guard down, because we expected him sooner. He promotes shopkeeper values when we expect dramatic displays of impulse enthusiasm designed to gain attention and glory for ourselves. I'll take church overseers any day who are like Paul describes, to ones who are loud and flamboyant and always making a big noise, but can never be counted on when you're in trouble and you have to pick up the phone. The funny thing about the Jesus people, we hear about them now, they only lasted a couple years. Kind of started in 67 and was pretty much done by 71, 72. Hardly lasted at all. Why? Because all of these people that went to San Francisco and did those drugs and had that sex and participated in the whole movement and everything, that doesn't last long, and pretty quickly, most of them who sort of found Jesus, well, you know what they did? They settled down, and they got jobs, and they went to church, and they raised families. And in fact, that movement launched Christian contemporary movement. We wouldn't have a lot of the songs we sing today if it weren't for them. The idea of using drums and guitars and something other than the organ, that all came through this movement. The seeker movement, the megachurch movement, all these elements of American evangelicalism came through this. The movement itself sort of died away, but it impacted, and it would lead to really the, it's funny, if you hang out a little longer and listen to the Anglicans, one minute they'll sing these Anglican British hymns, another minute they'll sing Nigerian songs, and a minute later the pastor will be singing some Christian contemporary music. All of this stuff gets weaved in to the process. Realized shopkeeper apocalyptic in Christianity seems to keep adding some chaos when church gets too rigid. The movie itself is about churches that everyone had their hair short, and they all sat in good rows and sang nice songs, and someone came and bell bottoms and long hair. Today someone comes in with long hair. We don't think a thing of it. That was shocking. Many of you remember that. Church could get too rigid. God shakes it up with some apocalypse. Church is too chaotic. God settles it down with some order. Back and forth it goes. Shopkeeping keeps the chaos from getting too disruptive, to ruin faith, intergenerational transmission. Yeah, you can go to San Francisco and be a hippie, but if you have a kid, guess what? That kid likes to have milk in the fridge and a backpack to go to school and mom and dad there to pick him up, doing drugs and raising the kid. Don't really work too well together. Kids don't like parents as drug addicts. It doesn't work. These shopkeeper values also keep emerging. Is there enough realized apocalypse in your life? Now, many of you are getting older, and you're probably saying, I could use with less apocalypse, thank you. I'd like my body to work. I'd like less concerned about cancer and heart disease and my money running out and the economy going belly up when I can't really go back into the job market and earn money. Yeah, I get that. There's a lot of realized apocalypse potential the older you get. Are you prepared for the inbreaking of the apocalyptic Jesus in your life? The day of the Lord can and will come in unexpected ways. We all get to see the day of the Lord. Question is, do we see it through our death? Or do we see it on the big stage in the world? But we all see it. Is there enough shopkeeping in your life? Are you in the kind of training, disciplined worship, prayer, study, sacrifice that puts oil in your jar to light your lamp when the bridegroom arises? That's the question of this parable. Are you ready to enter the feast and not be left on the other side of the door to hear the master say, "Well, I don't know you"? That's the hard question Jesus leaves us with. Let's pray. Lord, the apocalypse comes for each of us. Whether we're traveling through the woods at night, whether we're going to the doctor's office with a concern that might be more than we expect, whether it comes on a big stage and a whole generation is impacted by it, or it comes in a little moment and we feel ourselves isolated and alone in it. Lord, you promise to be with us, but you invite us to be with you before the apocalypse commences. Help us, Lord, to seek you and find you seeking us. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen.